Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Thank you for joining us in this latest edition of the OIES podcast series. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm chairman of the Natural Gas Programme at the Institute. It's my great pleasure today to be joined by a good friend, Professor Jonathan Stern, who's Distinguished Research Fellow at the Institute. And we're here today to discuss the future of gas in the climate journey, developments over the last four and a half years, and what's next. And this is part of the two podcasts that the OIS is recording in recognition of it publishing 100 podcasts since early 2017. Now, just to timestamp this podcast, in the ever-changing market, we're recording it on the morning of Friday, the 8th of July. Jonathan, welcome back to the OIS podcast series.
Thank you, David. Very good to be here. I think I'm doing 101 instead of 100 because I'm older than everybody else.
Well, you said that, not me, Jonathan, so that's great. Now, Jonathan, since January 2017, when let's be honest, even COP21 targets were considered challenging and net zero targets were not really under consideration, you've now published 5 papers under the theme, The Future of Gas. And I think it's fair to say that you've been pretty vocal on this subject at a time when many people were really not ready to listen. So perhaps, what are the key changes that have happened since you wrote the first papers in 2017?
Okay, well, in 2017, net zero was not in our vocabulary. Hydrogen was in our vocabulary, but not with all of these rainbow colours that we now have. Methane emissions were sort of in our vocabulary, but not to any great level of urgency. And the whole notion of carbon neutral, or as I prefer to talk about it, LNG cargoes with a defined greenhouse gas content, was certainly not in our vocabulary. So our world has definitely moved on in that period.
Okay, so have you been surprised by the reaction of the fossil fuel community to the IEA's net zero by 2050, a roadmap for global energy sector publication? Because there seems to be quite a lot of discussion amongst the industry players, some positive, some negative.
Well, I should declare, I was a peer reviewer of the study, so I kind of crawled all over a lot of it and have done again since it's been published. Much of the commentary, I think, has been done by people who've not actually read the study. A lot of the comments have said that the study is saying, oh, we don't need any more fossil fuel production. It's not saying that. Some of the commentary is saying, oh, it's unrealistic to imagine that fossil fuels can be phased out, that the IEA has somehow been captured by NGOs and has become sort of environmentally trendy. So let's go back to what the IEA was asked to do, strangely enough, by the British government as the chair of the COP26 meeting. It was asked to come out with a modelling outcome which produced a net zero scenario. Not the only way to produce a net zero scenario, but one way to do it. So it's not clear whether critics are saying that they think net zero is unrealistic by 2050, or whether they're saying the IEA has done a modelling run which is not realistic and should have done a lot better. For me, what's interesting is that I haven't seen anyone coming forward with another scenario which achieves net zero, but with a much different fossil fuel outcome. In other words, those people who say, oh, it's all far too quick and we can't do it. Well, yeah, maybe, but have you got a scenario which achieves the same outcome with a very different fossil fuel trajectory? The IEA itself benchmarked its scenario against a number of IPCC net zero scenarios, which show that the IEA is very low on CCUS and direct air capture, and much, much higher on things like hydrogen and renewables. So, of course, if you've got a net zero scenario with a lot more CCUS, then you can have a lot more fossil fuels. But again, these are modelling scenarios, and I don't think people have really appreciated that's what the aim of this was.
Okay, so what are your reactions to the study compared to those that you've heard maybe from others? Do you support what the study is saying? Is the intent right, but the details are perhaps under debate? What are your views on that?
For me, the strange thing is that the most controversial part of the study for me is something that I haven't read any commentary on at all. And that is the section on affordability and behavioural changes. Now, okay, this is quite a long way towards the end of the study, and it's long. Maybe a lot of people haven't read that far. Maybe they were only interested in reading the fossil fuel stuff. But, I mean, for me, it's very controversial to say that household bills in advanced economies are going to decline by nearly 20% in the period 2020 to 2030. And emerging economy developing country bills are going to increase, not hugely, but somewhat, over the next decade. Now, the reason for me that's very controversial is that I believe in order to move as fast as a lot of advanced economies want to move this decade, we're going to have to spend a huge amount of money. When I say we, I mean we as taxpayers and we as bill payers. Of course, as NGOs will point out absolutely correctly, the money we spend now is going to be far less than the money we're going to have to spend if climate damage is as bad as environmentalists say it's going to be if we don't reduce these emissions. Nevertheless, my point is that this generation, i.e. us, we are going to have to pay a very significant amount of money so that future generations have the kind of environment that they will need in order to stop the worst of the climate damage. And just adding on this, and the IEA study doesn't go into this in a lot of detail because it's focused on mainly energy. But lifestyle changes and obviously speed limits, moving to electric cars, having less cars, digitization of your home. Okay, this may not be a big deal to accept, but I think for some people it will be. But I also think it'll cost some money. But, you know, when we move to things like diet of eating less meat and dairy, I mean, then you're into, I think, really difficult territory to imagine that it's going to be acceptable in a lot of countries. So I could go on endlessly about what I felt about the study. But for me, the things that struck me were clearly not the things that struck most people who are commenting on this.
Certainly, Jonathan, it's the insights that you give that are of interest to our podcast listeners. But why don't we kind of move forward in our discussion and ask perhaps what is next for the gas and LNG community in the climate journey? Now, why don't we start by talking about the development of natural gas-based hydrogen with CCS? And now, how important is that the hydrogen is blue? Because we hear all these expressions. What are your views on that?
Look, the problem for blue hydrogen is essentially the carbon capture, utilization and storage. You know, how long have we been talking about this? Been talking about it for decades. How much carbon dioxide is being captured now? You know, we've got about 40 million tons worth of projects worldwide. If we add in all of the projects that anyone has talked about so far, we've got about 200 million tons. Whereas if you look at the IEA study, they're talking about 1.5 billion tons of CCUS by 2030. They're talking about 5 billion tons by 2050. The BP Net Zero study has higher numbers than that. The problem for blue hydrogen is not that we don't know how to do it, but we know it's quite expensive. The problem is we've got to scale it up in a huge way on a timescale that now looks very difficult. And if we can't scale up CCUS, then blue hydrogen does not work and everything has to move to green hydrogen. Now, at the Institute, some of us have made the proposition that actually you need to jumpstart your hydrogen economy with blue before you get to green. And I personally agree with that. But of course, if you can't make blue work because you haven't got the carbon capture, then that's not going to be feasible.
It's interesting because I think it does show, doesn't it, Jonathan? There's going to be different solutions for different players in the transition over the coming years. But what about methane emissions then? Because this is something that's really been at the heart of a lot of your research over the last 3 years.
Well, you know, a lot of the solutions for climate are going to be very expensive, very long term, and really very difficult to do. Methane emissions from the oil and gas industry should not be difficult to do. Everyone identifies them as one of the easiest, lowest cost, to some extent, negative cost. In other words, you can save money by doing this, and quickest to achieve. And incidentally, the IEA Net Zero study has 75% of global methane emissions from the oil and gas sectors being abated in this decade by 2030 as a key building block. One thing that I would say is that coal has escaped a lot of attention. And given that methane emissions from coal globally are nearly as much as oil and gas separately, and given the fact that there is so much coal still being produced in the world, we need a lot more attention being devoted to coal emissions. We also need a lot more attention being devoted to abandoned wells, as they have incidentally in Canada. Because, of course, once a company has abandoned a well, it's not keen to spend a lot of money on it, making sure that the methane emissions that are currently escaping, albeit on a minor level, are capped. But all of this stuff is really so much easier than a lot of the other net zero problems that we face. And it's a quick win for the oil and gas sector, which I think is in serious need of quick wins, particularly with the international community.
Okay, now you've written a lot about the importance of measuring emissions along the gas and the LNG chain. So could you perhaps share with our listeners your perspective on carbon neutral LNG?
Okay, I have a big problem with carbon neutral LNG as it has been practiced up till now. Now, I know we're only talking about 15, possibly up to 20 cargoes. We're not sure that we know all about each one of them. But this is a major problem of principle that the industry has to solve. So we're told about these cargoes. We're told sometimes where they come from, where they go, where they went to, what offsets were used. We have no transparency of any of the metrics. So we don't know what the greenhouse gas content was. We don't know how that was measured, whether anybody verified that independently, how the offsets were calculated. This, I'm afraid, if you present this to an NGO, they dismiss this as classic greenwash. I am much keener on the approach that a company like Pavilion is taking with some of its long-term contract customers, where what they're saying is, right, well, we want to develop a defined methodology for each cargo in the long-term contract. And we want to agree how that is going to be measured, how it's going to be reported, and how it's going to be verified. Now, they've said it, they haven't done it yet. We understand that's an ongoing project. But for me, that is a much better way of approaching the question of how do we verify and then try to reduce the greenhouse gas content, that's CO2 and methane, of LNG cargoes. And I think the industry has to understand that if there's no transparency, there's no credibility.
But what I think worries me, Jonathan, is that almost everybody seems to be doing their own thing at the moment, with different companies developing their own methodologies and own measurement regimes. Do you think it's going to be possible to have one global measurement and reporting system for this, what is very, very important part of the development, further development of the hydrocarbon business?
I mean, I think that's desirable because then you can have tradability between the different offsets, between the different cargoes. And because LNG is increasingly a traded commodity, it's not so much any longer a bilateral place-to-place commodity. It would be very helpful to have a global accepted methodology. And I think we'll work our way towards that. But before we get there, if you have a transparent regime where you say, here is the greenhouse gas content of this cargo, here is how it was measured by asset, by value chain, and this company verified those measurements for us. And this is not an accounting company that basically said, okay, show us what you think the emissions are. Yes, that looks reasonable. This is a technical company who did this via sampling from the field, from the pipeline, from the LNG plant, from the ship. This is what we need to work towards. Now, I can see that there might be different ways of measuring and different verification methods. Like I say, hopefully we'll make our way towards a common one at some stage. But this is the way we have to go in order to get credibility. Can I just mention two more things here, which seem to me to I get these responses from companies. One is about confidentiality. And for me, there is nothing confidential about what the greenhouse gas content of an LNG cargo is. There may be something confidential about what the payments are, what the prices are, you know, who's paying for offsets, how much they're paying. That may be confidential. Personally, I don't think it is, but I can at least enter into that discussion. The second thing that people say to me a lot is, you know, we're a commercial company. We have to make profits for our shareholders. Let me tell you guys, we all recognize that you're in the business of making profits. But if you don't realize what's happening out there in terms of the necessity to ensure that you have credible emissions that governments can take into account when they're doing their greenhouse gas accounting, you are not going to have a big future in the energy business.
Certainly a very clear message there, Jonathan. But why don't we kind of move the discussion kind of upwards a bit, and perhaps, you know, a fundamental issue, you know, which is the pace and the speed of the transition. And I think my question, therefore, is, you know, is the gas community moving fast enough in different parts of the world on the energy transition journey?
You know, I think we've got to acknowledge the fact that in some parts of the world, the energy transition is not as important as it is in, say, Europe, where it is fundamental. You know, if you move towards Asia, former Soviet Union countries, this is not high on the agenda, as not nearly as high as other issues like affordability, security. But nevertheless, all these countries have signed up to COP21. They've all signed up to Paris targets. If you're in Europe, the urgency is very great, and I don't think the speed is fast enough. The key thing really, as I say, is that the industry is very, very good at talking to itself. It's very good at convincing itself that it's doing a lot. It's not so good at talking to the world and listening when the world is saying, you're not doing enough and you're not doing it fast enough.
Okay, so that leads us to a fundamental question. You know, how can the countries and the areas that aren't moving, as we see it, fast enough, move faster?
I mean, this is where maybe I part company with a lot of the commentary that's out there, particularly the NGO commentary, in that I just think, as I think I said earlier, it's going to cost a lot more money to move fast towards these targets than I see being committed. You know, we hear a lot about the just transition, you know, making sure that nobody's left behind. And that's a great sentiment. And of course, we all not just accept it, but we all agree that that's what our ideal should be. The problem is, I don't think it's happening. People talk about lots of money being committed. For example, the EU has committed 750 billion euros and a large chunk of that is going to go to climate-related projects. Now, that's great. I don't want to talk against that. But, you know, let's reduce that to 27 countries over 7 years. That's 2 to 3 billion euros a year. Now, that isn't enough to move the needle. OK, some of the countries are small, some are bigger. But you know, when I hear governments talk about, oh, we're going to spend X billion over this many years, you know, I see if we're going to meet these 2030 targets in Europe, for example, we're going to need to spend tens of billions every year in the big countries. Now, a lot of people don't agree with that. A lot of people say, no, we're not. Basically, renewables are just going to get so cheap that, you know, it's all going to be electrified. It's all going to be really cheap. We're going to be able to build the power lines. You fossil fuel guys, you're just locked into it, the wrong paradigm. Well, maybe that's right. Maybe I'm just an old guy who is locked into a fossil fuel paradigm. I don't think I am. What I think, though, is that it's going to cost a lot more money than people think to get there quickly. You know, if we're getting there slowly, maybe not. But to get to get to the kind of targets we're talking about. You know, so in the UK, we're talking about, you know, well over 60% reductions by 2030. Is it 78 by 2035? I mean, these are big numbers. So my feeling is, I would like to see, and we're going to see at COP26, whether the kind of international transfers are going to get honoured. You know, we've got the Indian government saying to us, you created this problem, you want us to solve the problem, you give us money. You know, is that going to happen? I mean, I hope so, but I don't see it at the moment. These are the kind of problems that I see not on the horizon. I see them this year in November in Glasgow. And I don't see an immediate way of solving that without big financial transfers, which, of course, are problematic.
Okay, well, perhaps we need to kind of ask the question, Jonathan, what happens if we don't see the pace of transition? So I expect my question is, if it becomes clear that many countries are not going to meet their 2030, let alone their 2050 targets, do you think we can honestly expect climate-related litigation?
I mean, I think we can expect litigation. We've already started litigation, although I'm not sure that it's targeted in the right place. But, you know, where countries have legally binding targets, I'm not entirely certain I understand what that term means, but where you can take a company or a government to court and say, if you do this or don't do this, you are not going to meet your commitments, which are legally binding, and therefore we want the court to compel you to do it or not to do it, then maybe that is a way of resolving something. But nevertheless, I'm sorry to keep coming back to money, but this is going to require money to be spent. And the question is, are governments going to be willing to spend the money? And I think an answer to that is, well, is this electorally possible? In other words, are people going to vote for governments who are going to spend a lot of money, or are they going to vote against governments who want to spend a lot of money? And that's where we come back to, you know, the real big question of how much money is involved. I think a lot. Some people think not so much. Maybe they're right. If they're right, maybe this isn't such a big deal. But I think the next decade is going to require huge amounts of money to be spent. That's got to come from taxpayers or bill payers.
And Jonathan, of course, as you said, you know, the whole affordability issue, the whole requirement for a lifestyle change if we're going to achieve these targets. And I think you raise a really important point about, you know, electorally this is possible, because, of course, politicians often have relatively short-term time horizons when they're playing in a long-term game. So I think that kind of leads me to my last question, which I always ask this as a last question when I do these podcasts, which is a kind of forward-looking question, and really a simple question, but not easy to answer. And that is, where do you think this is all going to end up?
Okay, well, I mean, to the first part of what you just said, what I would say is, we don't need any more inspirational speeches. We don't need any more ambitious targets. You know, we've got all that stuff now. What we need is action. And I think we need action in two respects. Firstly, we need to see whether technologies are going to move on fast. For me, the most important ones are electrification, hydrogen. Those are on the supply side. And on the demand side, digitization. You know, is it going to be possible very, very soon to switch off all of the appliances in your house which you're not using or which can be switched off while you're asleep by an automatic method so you don't have to do anything? And all of this stuff seems to me to be possible. Everybody talks about it. The question is, how fast can it be done? And then looking forward, I would say that I see many things having a relatively simple solution. But heating, and particularly urban heating in the Northern Hemisphere countries, I think is much more problematic. Not that it can't be solved. You know, we know all about heat pumps. We know all about district heating. But if you have an established large urban city and you have very cold winters and you already have a particularly a gas distribution grid, I think that's going to be hard to change. But in a sense, it's the wrong question. The question is, what must we do if we're going to avoid the kind of world that climate scientists are telling us is coming over the horizon? And for that, you need to really look at where we are now and say, in a sense, whatever it costs, are we prepared to pay that cost? And whatever that means for our jobs and our lifestyles. And frankly, I don't know the answer to that question.
Well, Jonathan, thank you very much. As always, you know, I've really enjoyed our conversation today in this, the 101st OIES podcast. And I hope you, our podcast listeners, have enjoyed it. Thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.